If you've ever wondered, am I doing enough at work, in your relationships, as a parent, or just as a person? You, of course, are not alone. So many of my clients feel like they have to prove their value through performance, productivity, or being good enough for someone to love or respect them. Today, we'll explore the difference between self-worth and self-esteem, the signs that your sense of worth has become transactional. I'll explain what that means. And 5 practical ways to break this pattern and start living from a place of grounded, unconditional self-worth. Today, you'll learn why love should never be a job interview. So stay tuned. I'm Dr. Abby Metcalf, and I'm a practicing psychologist, #1 Amazon best-selling author, TEDx speaker, and all-around relationship maven with over 35 years of experience helping people just like you. Join me as I teach you actionable tips and strategies to create connection, joy, and ease in all your relationships. So let's get to it. Welcome back to the podcast. Wonderful to have you here. And what do I always say when I start? I got a great one for you today. It's just interesting that there's certain things that get trending, so to speak, with my clients or in my online One Love community or somewhere else. And it's like different people are asking me the same question. So I always know when it's time for an episode to go deep on something. And we just have a few episodes left of this season, season 7. Thank you for listening and following and leaving reviews. If you haven't yet, please do. I wouldn't be doing this without you. So just so grateful. All right. So let's first talk about self-worth versus self-esteem versus performance identity. Yeah, those are the Let's first talk about that. Okay. We have to define what we're talking about and get clarity on what's driving how you feel about yourself. So self-worth is basically your sense of intrinsic value. It means you believe you're worthy, simply because you exist. There's an internal intrinsic value. Self-esteem is how you evaluate yourself, which is often based on performance or external validation or something else. So see, there's a difference right there. And then performance identity is when your value is tied entirely to what you do, not who you are. Okay? So Carl Rogers, he's one of the founders of humanistic psychology and really what we call person-centered psychology. I know that sounds crazy when you think of therapy and you're like, it used to not be human. It used to not be person-centered. Correct. You'd be correct. It really wasn't till Rogers came around. It was always, people that did therapy were medical doctors. People like Sigmund Freud was a medical doctor. They went to school for medicine and then they got into psychiatry because psychiatry, remember, is different than like, I'm a psychologist, not a psychiatrist. I did not go to medical school. I did not do any of those things. And a psychiatrist can write a script, for anything, any medication. I cannot write scripts. Okay. So it's just a whole different schooling. So Rogers came along and was like, we should treat them with value and respect, not as like, you're wrong, here's your pathology, here's what's wrong with you, and let's treat it. So it's what he called unconditional positive regard. Isn't that beautiful? Don't you wish everyone in your life could treat you with unconditional positive regard? It's really just the belief that people are worthy of love and respect simply by being human, regardless of your behavior or your achievement or how much money you make or how pretty you are. So, was new on the scene, I guess almost 100, not 100 years ago yet, but maybe like 60 years ago now, 70 years ago. And that's really when we started looking, and it was only after that that we started really researching, and I've got a lot of research in today's episode, as I always do, I usually do. We started researching this idea that you have intrinsic self-worth. You just because you're human, it's enough. You don't have to do to earn love. But most people don't grow up with this unconditional regard, right? Instead, we often grow up with something we psychologists call contingent self-worth. I'm using a lot of big words today, right? Transactional, contingent, all that, because I have a smart audience. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. If you're listening, you're smart. You're a smarty pants. You like to learn. You want to understand psychology. You're really probably psychologists yourself or students of it. I get a lot of people actually who are in students or in school. Shout out. We need more people who are really know what they're doing. So thank you. And I do always try to explain everything, you know, what I mean by it, which I'm about to do. But I also want to let you know that I never ever dumb down material for you because I know I don't need to and I don't want to. And you're worth it. You're worth hearing all the things. So contingent self-worth, you know, where does that start? And where does it start and what does it do, I guess, right? So contingent self-worth means you believe you are lovable or valuable only under certain conditions. It's contingent, right? It's depending on something. That's kind of right what that means. So contingent self-worth means that you don't necessarily have self-worth just for who you are. Again, this intrinsic idea of value, but that it's you're only that love or that value is only under certain conditions. And this could mean obviously being successful, being liked, being selfless, being thin, being the one who never causes conflict. So you may not consciously think that love or safety is earned, but you might be surprised like today to go, oh, my behavior tells a different story about that, right? And we'll get deep. So, and the research is really clear that people with high contingent self-worth are more anxious, they're more vulnerable to depression, they're more likely to feel rejected, and they're more reactive to failure, to feedback of any kind. So yeah, there you go. They often really struggle with being authenticity in relationships, meaning that they're really themselves. They often suppress their true emotions. I see a lot of over-functioning to stay, you know, deserving of love, to be deserving of inclusion, you know, being included, of belonging. And this obviously doesn't just happen. It, you know what, where does it start? You know where, probably childhood. And let me say this, I have a really great giveaway for today's episode. It's a self-worth assessment to really help you figure out if you're living transactionally. And when I say transactionally, that's what we're talking about today. It's a transaction, right? If I go buy something at a store, that's a transaction. I'm handing them money and they're handing me a product or a good or something. And when we live or love transactionally, it means that I think I have to give you something to be worthy of you loving me or, you know, of getting something from you. Does that make sense? Yeah. So whenever you hear that, you might have been thinking, what do they mean when they say transactional love or I'm being transactional in this? You might be transactional in your relationships where you are expecting something in return. That's like a string attached, right, to something. And so many people just grow up this way and they're fish who don't know they're wet. You know, I like to say that. Don't even realize. I can't tell you how many clients or people I talk to and they're like, that's not right. I'm like, yeah, no, that's not how it's supposed to go. So where does it come from, right? Families that emphasize, you know, achievement, appearance, compliance, or emotional control. And that can be explicit or implicit. In other words, that could be said or unsaid, just something that you feel. Those kind of families often raise kids who tie their value to what they do rather than who they are. And I'll give you some examples, but I can tell you now that like growing up, you know, I've shared my mom was a narcissist and we love my mom. There's no hate to my mom. She's been dead a few years. But when you grow up with a narcissist, everything is transactional. Everything is being a good, you know, for me, it was being a good girl, being the good kid, being the whatever. And when I wasn't, or when I didn't act as I was supposed to, and that wasn't always told to me how I was supposed to act, then love was withheld, or there was this anger, or this stonewalling, or these different things. So you learn, right? Oh, if I act this way, and then you learn, of course, to kind of lie, to sort of show the world a part of yourself because you don't feel like all of you is accepted or acceptable, right? So definitely parents who withhold affection when a kid fails or misbehaves. So I know even that, think of that. So if your parent got, you know, if I got angry at my kid, just this, you get angry at your kid and they do something that's wrong, you know, bad, whatever. Maybe they talk back, I don't care. And then I punish them and then won't talk to them, won't give them love, won't whatever. I did not do that as a mom. I knew I had to tell my kid, I love you very much. I do not like this behavior. You still, you know, you have to be punished. You're going to go to your room or get grounded or whatever's going to happen, right? You have to apologize, whatever. But I never withheld my love. So, and a lot of times kids would say, well, can I have a hug? I'm like, absolutely. And now you have to go to your room, you know, like you can have a hug and then you still have to, but to understand that they were still lovable and yet there still might be consequences. A lot of people, you know, right now you're listening going, oh my gosh, that was not what happened. Or maybe, and I don't want you to feel guilty, maybe you do this as a parent yourself and you realize now like, oh my gosh, that is, I'm so mad at my kids sometimes and I won't talk to them for a while. I'm just so pissed or whatever. You know, this is from something you learned and we want to unlearn it. So you also might be this way if you grew up in a home where emotions were dismissed or even punished, you know, stop crying, I'll give you something to cry about kind of houses, right? Was that just my day? I don't know if that still goes on. If you grew up in an environment where like love or approval was conditional on success, right? I'm proud of you because you got an A. And if you don't get an A, if you even got a B sometimes, then, you know, I don't want to talk to you. You don't know how to succeed. You're never going to get anywhere like that. You know, and somehow again, it was withheld or you were made to feel bad or wrong that you weren't getting an A or doing the right thing or the captain of the football team or whatever it might've been. It also can happen with families where caregiving or responsibility is overly placed on the child. We call this parentification. When a kid acts more like a parent, those kids, it becomes really problematic. And I will tell you that the more kids you have in a household, the more this is a problem. Okay. Very, very much, but I'm not going to get into that today. All right. So, and in particular, I would say, in particular, I would say that, so there's, not I would say, there's research on parenting styles that shows that authoritarian parenting, which means it's high in control and low in warmth, okay, that's where we see a lot of this. So high in control, low in warmth, and any kind of parenting where there's a lot of conditional regard are strongly linked in the research to increase contingent self-worth in those kids. It doesn't, right? You don't have to be Freud to figure that out. That's going to, you know, link together. So if you had parenting that was very authoritarian, but there wasn't a lot of warmth, usually what we do is like, there's like a picture on top, like a square and picture on, and it's cut into fours, right? Like four, you know, a line in the middle and a line through this, you know, horizontal and a vertical line. So up top, you have authoritarian and permissive. Those are the two kinds of parenting. And then you have warm and cold. And when you can kind of draw like into the boxes, right? If you take the authoritarian parent and link it to the cold, right? Authoritarian cold, which is what we're talking about, you're going to get this problem. Authoritarian warm is linked to really great outcomes for kids. Obviously not too authoritarian, but I worked hard to stay there. So there's rules, it's very clear, there's a bedtime, there's a this, there's a that, and there's a lot of warmth and love. Permissive parenting, so you could be very permissive, allow your kid to do anything, and cold, like really just, that's just a totally disconnected parent who lets them do anything, but really has no regard for them, you know, isn't really involved in their lives almost at all. And you can have very permissive and very warm, which is also linked to really poor outcomes. think about that. You're really permissive, and you're really, really loving. Those kids, I say with love, often end up spoiled and entitled and have other issues, Okay, I know. So you want to lean, if you're a parent, towards authoritarian warm as much as you can. So just keep that in mind. But anyway, and especially in regards to this, you know, to this contingent self-worth in kids, you really don't want that. So, and even, I want to say clearly, well-meaning praise, even that can reinforce performance-based, you know, identity in a kid. You know, a kid who's constantly told, you're so smart, it's a problem. Instead of, you worked hard on that, I'm so proud of you. It's not, I'm proud of you, you got an A. It's, I'm so proud of you, you worked really hard on this. You know, you did a lot of work for this. And, you know, when there's that, they really grow up believing, again, their worth hinges on them being exceptional, so smart, so beautiful, so talented, so athletic. So I did an episode a while ago, I'll link to it, on Carol Dweck's work. I love saying her name, Dweck, because I always feel like I want to say Uwaskwewabit. Carol Dweck's work, she's at Stanford now. She used to be at Columbia. She wrote Mindset, which I think is the most important parenting book anyone can ever read, even though that's it's for parents, teachers, coaches. I think it says something like that in the subtitle. Her work with fixed and growth mindset, you should check that out. And you can check out that episode. I'll link to it for much more information on this if you're really into the parenting part. But I talked about it, having a growth mindset, just for having really getting out of a victim mentality, right? So I did a whole episode on that. And again, I'll link to it. So I personally, I've come to believe that contingent self-worth is a result of a lot of factors. But the way I describe it to my clients is that I compare it to what happens to puppies, okay? And I'm in no way trying to tell you you're like a dog, okay? I want to be really clear. But I found that this metaphor really works for people. And I don't find it surprising that this animal that most people love has a very similar thing. So let me just explain it. So puppies have fear imprint stages, or what they call sometimes fear weeks. And puppies go through two distinct kind of fear periods during early development. And what's a fear period? What is this? It's a window of heightened sensitivity where a negative experience can leave really a lasting emotional and behavioral imprint on the dog. Kind of like wet cement that hardens with whatever gets stuck in it, right? That's what happens. So fear period one is, I think it's 8 to 11 weeks. I should know for sure. I'm 99% sure. It's 8 to 11 weeks. My puppy people out there, let me know. And this coincides with when puppies are often first separated from their litter, right? And they're sent to their new homes. And a lot of people won't give puppies away in those weeks. They wait till they're 12 weeks old, or they do it right at 8 weeks before it starts so that the dog is really protected. They're not in some, right? Because, so, you know, they're adjusting to new people, smells, sounds, and anything that's scary during that time, you know, a loud bang, a rough interaction with the dog, a vet visit gone wrong, it becomes hardwired as a fear response if it happens during those weeks. So if a dog, let's say a puppy, maybe gets bit by another dog at week 9, you know, if they're in their fear week somewhere in there, they might be afraid of dogs the rest of their lives. Like, it's like, again, the wet cement. You can't untrain it. And the second, they have another fear period around 6 to 14 months, which really overlaps with their adolescence. And I got to tell you, I think people are the same. I think, you know, they're just very young and then things can happen. And then during the teen years, things can happen that have lasting results. And just like with some adolescents, I think the puppies can look kind of grown, but they're still neurologically immature. Think about how many kids, you know, are tall for their age or something. They seem older and then they're not. And all the bad, or young girls who seem more developed or look older than they are and are getting all the sexual attention when they're like 10. You know what I mean? Yeah, it really bad things happen. So again, if something happens during those weeks, they may suddenly become fearful of things they previously tolerated. So they got through the first fear weeks, right? But then something happens in that second fear period, you know, strangers, could be a hat, garbage can, someone walking funky. And because the amygdala is running the show and they're building these sort of long-term emotional like templates, for lack of a better word, right? Based on how safe or unsafe the world feels. And people do it too. And so fear periods in these puppies really shape their social confidence, their emotional regulation, just like early experiences in humans, right? Shape our contingent self-worth. It's amazing. And puppies, and I would say people, in those fear periods need consistent, safe, attuned caregivers to reassure them, to give them love. Otherwise, you know, you learn the world's dangerous and I have to fend for myself. Yeah. Humans in childhood, right, need the same. When a child is in an emotional distress, right? Let's say they're scared, they're sad, they're ashamed, and their caregivers ignore them, punish them, withdraw love. A kid is going to learn my emotions are a threat to connection and I have to perform to be accepted. Are you hearing me? Oh yeah, pregnant pause there. That's right, because I dropped the mic. No, I was kidding. I'm not going to drop my mic. It's very expensive, my microphone. So fear periods are biological vulnerability windows. That's right. That's what they are for puppies and for people. I want you to think about it because, again, it's biological vulnerability because it gets hardwired in. So what happens during those windows becomes internalized. It's like a blueprint for safety, a blueprint for love, for belonging. And obviously in humans, we don't call them fear weeks. We call them, what do we call them? We call them attachment patterns. We call it emotional neglect. We call it childhood conditioning. We call it adverse childhood experiences or ACEs, right? But it's the same wiring underneath. Same wiring. When you're young and afraid and someone shames you, withdraws or only responds when you're performing or being quote unquote like good, you start to internalize that safety, love, approval have to be earned. And the nervous system, your nervous system doesn't forget that, right? It doesn't forget without doing some serious rewiring, which we're going to talk about today. Okay. Are you picking up what I'm laying down here? Are you getting where I'm going? Okay. I'm hoping that helped. So yeah, I'm not belittling our problems saying we're like puppies, but I think that can give you a picture of what it's like for humans because it's so obvious in puppies. I do want to talk a minute about, you know, sort of gender, culture, some culture, maybe a little culture. I'll see how I'm feeling, but definitely gender influences on worth. And it's, because it's not just your family. Obviously, the broader culture plays a significant role too. And I will say culture. So in Western individualistic societies, like the United States, self-worth is often tied to independence, to achievement, to personal success, right? In collectivist cultures, think a lot of Asian cultures, Africa, places like that. If you're anything like me, you're bad at asking for help, like weirdly bad at it. I've been a busy gal for a long time now. Kids, partner, my own business, all the things that make for a full life these days. And my instinct always was to just white knuckle it and do it all myself. But I say it on this show all the time. Ask for help. You don't have to do it all. And meanwhile, there I was doing it all. And I finally changed all that from my podcast editor to the person who got 10 years of photos off my phone and into albums I actually look at. I found amazing people to help me on Upwork, and I've been using them for the last 8 years. And you don't need a business for any of this, any project, any size, planning an event, sorting out something at home, finally handling the thing on your list you keep avoiding. Upwork lets you find, hire, and pay expert freelancers all in one place. With Business Plus, you can access the top 1% of talent on Upwork, and with AI-powered shortlisting, you'll get matched to the right freelancer in under 6 hours. No endless searching required. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to connect with top talent ready to help you and your business grow. That's UPWORK.com, Upwork.com. Self-worth might hinge more on family reputation, on obedience, on how well you fulfill your role in the group, right? But in both cases, the message can still be that your value depends on how well you play your part. Your part just might be different depending on where you're from. I read this one study. That's right. I'll link to it for sure in the show notes. I'll go find it. But it was comparing, American and Japanese students. And the American kids, students, it's college age kids, right, were more likely to base self-worth on achievement, while the Japanese students tied it to more to social harmony and avoiding shame, right? So you know, the flavor of contingent self-worth was differing, but the impact was very similar. You get anxiety, you get perfectionism, you get never being able to sit still, you know, constant busyness, you get self-silencing. I'll go look up that. I'll make sure I include that in the show notes and in the blog and under the video if you're watching on YouTube. And remember to like and subscribe, please, if you're watching on YouTube. And the research shows that gender, there's definitely like another layer gender adds, because women are disproportionately taught to equate their worth with, of course, caregiving, with emotional labor, with likability. Men are more conditioned I'm broad brushstroking here, but you know I'm pretty close. Men are conditioned more to link their value to being competent, being stoic, to success, right? So again, the result is that, yeah, there's different rules, but we got the same trap, right? And women are especially vulnerable to performance-based worth because, you know, especially again in Western cultures, because socialization teaches girls to be relational, to be agreeable, responsible for other people's feelings. Boys are often taught to be competent, powerful, emotionally independent, right? Neither group really escapes the prove your worth mindset, but it just shows up differently. So in general, the research shows that females were more likely than males to base self-worth on relationships and approval from others, while males were more likely to tie self-worth to competence and success. Okay. Yeah. And I'll again link to all that. There's also the invisible labor of being nice, available, helpful, especially for women. Okay. Research on self-silencing, right? Which I mentioned, which is a behavior pattern where people sort of suppress their thoughts and needs to maintain relationships, shows that this pattern is strongly linked to depression. So when a woman asks, am I doing enough? It's, you know, it's often code for, have I earned the right to take up space, you know, to rest, to say no, to just be. Okay. I'm hoping this makes sense. So let's talk about what transactional worth looks like in real life. And, because you might think these are just, you know, normal ways to live, but they're often signs you've internalized a belief that love, that rest, that dignity needs to be earned. Okay. So these are common signs of what, you know, again, what we would call transactional thinking. One would be feeling like you have to explain or justify your needs, you know. You finally ask for a weekend to yourself, but follow it up with, you know, I've just been so busy lately and I don't want you to think I'm mad or selfish, right? Keeping a mental tally of what you've done for others, you notice you've been helping your friend move, you know, watching their kids, always texting first, maybe. And now you're kind of silently waiting for them to, you know, even the score kind of thing, right? Maybe you're feeling guilty for resting or doing something just for you. You take a nap or read a book and immediately you think, oh, I should be doing something more productive. You know, I'm wasting time. Another thing I see is apologizing for things that don't require an apology. You know, you say sorry when someone bumps into you, or you feel bad saying no to a dinner invite, even when you're exhausted. It's like, sorry, 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 sorry. What else do I see? Believing you need to be productive. Oh, I said that, didn't I? To deserve rest, right? You don't let yourself relax until like every dish is washed, every email is answered, the to-do list is clear, right? which of course is never, because who finishes that list? Avoiding asking for help. That's another one, because you should be able to handle it. You know, struggling silently with something at work or home, but you feel like asking for support would mean like you're failing somehow, not trying hard enough, that you're needy. What else do I see? Feeling anxious when you're not being praised or validated. I see that. You send maybe a thoughtful message or you do something kind, and then you feel uneasy if there's no enthusiastic reaction or thank you. You know, these aren't quirks. They're symptoms of living as if your value has to be continually proven, right? Okay. So let's talk about my five practices to break free from transactional worth, or from, right, having to, or contingent self-worth, or any, however we want to say this, okay? And this is, to me, how you shift from proving to them to trusting. You know, you're going to move from earning to owning your worth. That's what we're trying to do here. So number one, definitely, is practice receiving without repaying. So you're just going to practice this. Most people are deeply uncomfortable, right? Deeply uncomfortable receiving anything without feeling like you have to give something back, okay? So you want to try things like, my favorite, what I practice a lot, because I fall in this category, is when someone gives you a compliment, say thank you and shut up. That's it. Don't downplay it. Don't ignore it. Don't whatever. I also put my hand over my heart to really make myself feel it. So when someone gives me a compliment, I say thank you. I look them in the eye. I put my hand over my heart. And I try to really take it in. It's very hard. I'm not going to lie about it. It's easier now. I shouldn't say that. It's been hard for years and something I still have to consciously do. If a friend picks up the check, don't rush to say, you know, I'll get the next one. Let yourself sit with the discomfort of just receiving. Just receive it. Say thank you. Again, say thank you. Be gracious. Let your partner handle a task or bring you coffee without insisting, you know, I owe you one. Oh, I appreciate that. You know, now I'll get you next time. You know, again, don't even the score, so to speak. Definitely get rid of the list in your head that says whose turn it is to do something in your home or at work. There's no turns. We're not taking turns. And what happens is this practice rewires your nervous system to tolerate, quote unquote, unearned kindness, right? You don't have to earn kindness, but that idea, it's really a great, I would say, necessary step toward internalizing unconditional worth. Okay. Internalizing unconditional worth. Two is to give yourself unearned rest. This would be my second thing. So, you know, you don't need to collapse in exhaustion to justify a break. Rest isn't a luxury. It's a biological need. So try scheduling rest first in your calendar, not last. Yeah, I know. Crazy thought. Block off time. A 20-minute walk without your phone. An hour to read something unrelated to work. A nap just because you're tired. Laying out in the sun for half an hour. Whatever, right? Even 5 minutes of sitting without a task attached to whatever you're doing will help disrupt the pattern of equating worth with output. Start with 1 minute. Try five. If guilt shows up, name it. Oh, this is the part of me that believes I have to earn peace. Oh, this is that part of me that believes I have to earn peace, right? Just name it. Catch and interrupt the internal bargains is number three. So, again, got to be mindful. If you haven't downloaded my free mindfulness starter kit, I don't know what you're waiting for. Notice when you find yourself thinking, if I do X, then I'll deserve Y. If I'm helpful enough, they'll like me. If I push through, then I'll rest later, right? When you notice that, and you got to be mindful to notice, but when you do, I want you to stop. And I want you to ask yourself, what am I trying to earn right now? What am I trying to earn? What would I choose if I already believed I was enough? Those are your questions. You could even keep, I had keep a bargain journal for a week. And I had them just jot down every time that transactional voice in their head popped up. And seeing the pattern in writing was really powerful for both these people. I will tell you that right now. I'm sure I've done that more than I'm just thinking of these two. Okay. Number four is to write and reread a worth letter. So what you do is you write a letter from the part of you that knows you're already worthy, right? So it might say, I know you've spent a long time proving yourself, but you were never broken. You don't have to hustle for love. Not anymore. You are already enough, even on your worst day, right? And so it doesn't have to be maybe a whole, I would do longer than that. I'm not going to do that right now, but do a few paragraphs, something, and then post it where you'll see it. Read it when your self-worth wobbles, okay? Or flip it. Write the letter you needed to hear as a kid. What would a parent who loved you unconditionally say? What would they have said to you, right? I know. Number five is to stop keeping score in relationships. I talk about this in my TEDx. I've got all kinds of things about keeping score. You've heard me talk about it ad nauseum. Transactional love says, I did this, so now you owe me. But real connection is rooted in presence, not accounting. Okay? I want you to think of that. So when you give, ask like, would I still want to do this even if they never return the favor? Stop doing things just to be nice if you're going to build resentment later. Right? If you feel used, don't tally points. Set a boundary. So you want to give from a place of clarity, not obligation. Generosity should be a choice, not a test. Okay? I think that's enough. All right. So I'm going to wrap up and say this. And I do, as always, have a really great masterclass bundle for this episode. If this is a real issue for you and you're not part of my One Love Collective, my online community, who's going to get all these things, I would highly recommend, you just come on by and you can buy the bundle. You don't have to join the community. You can buy the bundle for $8. I would highly recommend it. I think it would probably be very helpful. But I'll explain everything that's in it in a minute. But I want to wrap up by saying, your worth was never up for debate. Okay, it was never up for debate. Your worth isn't based on what you produce, how much you give, or who approves of you. It doesn't spike when you overdeliver, and it doesn't disappear when you rest. You were born worthy. You don't have to prove it. You don't have to prove it. You only have to believe it. And then practice that belief in how you treat yourself every single day. I'm going to just end there. I like how I said that. I could never repeat that, but I like it. That's it for today. I hope this was really helpful. And remember that today there's a self-worth assessment to know if you're living transactionally or not. You are free to come download that anywhere where this podcast is, underneath the video, over at my website, blog post page, podcast page, all the places will have it. And then if that's it for you. Otherwise, I'm going to tell you everything that's in the bundle. If you're in my One Love Collective and you're in tier one, you are going to get boundary practice scenarios. So kind of saying no without negotiation. You're going to get a couple / family dynamics reflection. So it's like an earning love at home exercise that I created. You're also going to get a reparenting journal exercise. So what your younger self needed to hear. And actually, I'm throwing in a workplace worth reflection because I think this happens a lot at work. Okay. If you're in tier two, which is my love accelerator, everything in tier one, plus you don't have to earn this. It's really 25 reminders to anchor your self-worth. There's a deep reflection worksheet, where did I learn to earn? And there's a guided visualization in today's everything. If you are in tier three, which is my VIP Love Lab, you get everything in tiers one and two. Plus, I know I did so much for this episode. I was a little out of hand. A core belief reframe tool, a self-compassion script exercise, and a two-week daily practice tracker. I know, it's a lot. And again, if you pay $8, you can get all those things. If you are not part of my community, you can get all those things. And there you have it. So I'm really excited about today's episode. I think it was really needed. I'm hoping it helps a lot of people. And that's it. And you know, I think you're worth it. I love and adore you. You are so worthy. You're so worthy. Let's end on that. All right. Have an amazing week, and I will talk to you ever so soon.
Thank you for listening to the Relationships Made Easy podcast with wonderful me, Dr. Abby Metcalf. And I've got two quick things to say. Just give me one more minute. First, I love spending this time with you, and I work hard to make sure every single episode is going to help you move from any feelings of frustration or resentment or anxiety to that connected, hopeful confidence. That's always my goal. So if you have any ideas for a future episode or just want to say hi, let me know what the podcast is doing for you. Anything. You can email me at abby@abbymetcalf.com. How simple is that? And the second thing I want to say is if you like the podcast, you're going to go crazy for my book. My book is really good. I'm really proud of it. You can find it on Amazon or on my website under the shop section on my website at abbymetcalf.com. It's called Be Happily Married, Even If Your Partner Won't Do a Thing. And even if your partner will do a thing, the book will still really help you. So that's it. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you soon.